glimpse of light in the midst of darkness. For some, this light was blinding. For others, it was a soft flicker, enough to call us toward it. We know this light will last, and we trust that this light extends beyond death. So let us now collectively explore the next right step on the illuminated path. Welcome to the gathering.
We are in the second week of a series in short form we call Exiles. In long form, there is a really long run-on sentence title that I don't have in front of me, so we'll just go with Exiles. But the intent is to kind of bring us to a place. And what we're doing within this series is we're taking some time to walk through the first seven chapters of the book of Daniel. In the Hebrew scriptures, and so it's a very unique book. Scholars say that this book, in many ways, is the most unique in the entire Bible when it's written, how it's written, its style, the fact that it is written in two different languages. There's only one other book in the Hebrew scriptures that plays with the Aramaic as well, so we're going to ask you to read and speak in Aramaic this morning, and no English. So it's not one of those immersion things. So from here on out, it's just Aramaic is all we'll do this morning. It'll be fun, right? Nope. Me either. I'm not in with that. But we will do some Hebrew, of course, because there's Hebrew in there, and we got to get at that. And so I would love to pray, and then we're going to jump in, because we have ourselves an adventure this morning. Gracious God, we bless you for the gift of this morning, the opportunity to gather, and we now want to center ourselves in your word. We invite you to speak to us however you need to, that you would find us with open hearts and open minds for what you have for us. And then, as the psalmist said, then may the posture, the meditation of my heart and the words of my mouth bring honor and glory to you and you alone, my Lord, my rock, and my Savior. And so we are open. We have ears to hear and hearts that desire to understand. Speak to your kids. We pray this in the name of Christ. And the church said, amen. Amen. All right. We're going to be in chapter 1 of the book of Daniel. Technically, we're going to go through verses 8 through 21, the end of chapter 1. We got to back up a little bit just to get some context. But we just do this a little bit. So we've got a ways to go. I'm really excited. I've had 2 weeks previously that I didn't teach. I mean, it's like winding up a toy. So I'm ready to go. I've been looking very, very forward to this. And so to set our minds, to get us in place, what we need to do is we need to imagine if our country was invaded, imagine everything we know was destroyed, and then you were dragged off to serve under the rule of an insane dictator. How do you respond? What would you do if this happened? Welcome to the questions of the book of Daniel. Welcome to exile. This is what is happening as we step into this book. After seeing their homes and their city be invaded, it's captured, then burned, Judah, Jerusalem, it's burned, and then a remnant, some of the survivors, are dragged out of the soot and smoke, and then what they're going to do is they're going to be asked to trek through the Arabian or Syrian desert to get to Babylon. And so they're going to come to this place. We'll throw up a map first. And so we're going to go. And so you have Judah, Jerusalem here. And so that's where they start. And then they come across the desert. And they're going to be dragged to Babylon over here, or modern day Iraq. And so they're brought to this place. But as they come, this whole journey is, you've just watched everything you've known be invaded, burned, destroyed, and you've watched some of your community be killed, and then a number of you're just packed up, and now you're hauled across the desert to come to this foreign land. And this is all about intimidation. They're going to let you know, wherever you come from, whoever your gods are, they do not compare to our gods and the prosperity that we have that was given to us by our gods. And now you're going to experience that. And as you trek into Babylon, this is what you would come across. So the next one, you would head down this where there's these huge walls, and then you're going to come to this, which is known as the Ishtar Gate. The Ishtar, the goddess Ishtar, is one of the Babylonian gods. Ishtar is the god of life. And so you would come to this, and this is about intimidation. There'd be guards everywhere, and it's about setting it up. Now this, the Ishtar Gate, was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Next slide. So they made a replica of it in the Berlin Museum. And so this is part of the replica they have. And then the next three slides are pictures that I took when I was in Turkey and I was in a museum in Istanbul. And these panels are actually excavated, and they're from the ancient Ishtar Gate. These are actual panels. Next slide. And so you see that? That's part of the wall leading up to it. And then there's just these just animals, but there's representations of gods of worship. But it's all about setting up this massive, intimidating, you are now here and you are now under us as you come walking in. And it would be a scene, but it would set them to go, get ready, because here we go. We're going to settle now. What we do with the book of Daniel is we're going to settle in with this small remnant of people that had been taken from Jerusalem into Babylon, and we're gonna walk with them and try and put ourselves in their shoes and go, how do you handle being put into this foreign land under the rule of kind of an insane, and that's putting it mildly, an insane king, dictator, who's going to rule. And so we're going to follow them and watch them and hopefully extract some wisdom in how they navigated exile. How did they do that? And why I say that is, no, we haven't been hauled off to a foreign land, but our land, in many ways, has become foreign to us. It's been ravaged. It's been disrupted. It's been shaken by a pandemic and social strife and everything. And we find ourselves looking around and going, this isn't what it was. And we're wondering what it will be. And we're trying to figure out how and who will we be in the midst of all of this chaos. Yep, so we're going to join the remnant and off we go. So Daniel chapter 1, verse 5, we'll back it up, because the king, this insane king, assigned them, and that's this remnant, this small Jewish Hebrew remnant that is there. He assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years. And after that, they were to enter the king's service. Well, they're going to be trained. Fascinating. So imagine this crazed ruler of the foreign superpower orders for you and a few of your friends to be put into a strict 3-year regimen of the broadest global studies of religion and literature, and then in this culture of their culture, and then also put on a specific diet. There's the king's table that's going to have this daily specific diet, with the intent, the whole purpose, is to indoctrinate you in the ways of their empire. after those 3 years, it will only be those who excel as the best of the best will be invited to join the king's service. Now, we're going to lean in and we're going to spend some time with Daniel, but you'll see that he's been, as we go through, it could be Daniel that often's referenced to him, but he was given a new Babylonian name, Belteshazzar. It's a good time. And then his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, also known as their Hebrew names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, those are their Babylonian names, which is interesting. If people have heard of those names, they think of, oh yeah, we know those names. But those are their Babylonian names, which they're named after Babylonian gods. Because what they've tried to do is saying who you were and who you worshipped, because their names actually honored their God, Yahweh. And they said, we're taking that from you and we're giving you these names. And so they're already in this place and we're going to follow them along. Verse 8 of chapter 1. But Daniel, so their diet, regimen, here's what we're doing, we're going to indoctrinate. Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. So Daniel takes issue with the diet, which is that in and of itself. Whoa, so all this education, nothing, so it seems, but he's got a problem with the food. And so he takes issue. But here's the thing. How does Daniel protest? How does he push back? How does he resist? Is he violent? Is he belligerent? No, this is really good. Daniel simply asks for permission to abstain. How does he hold strong without strong-arming those in authority? Before Daniel even speaks to the official, it says that he resolved not to defile himself. Now, that word resolved is really fascinating. It's sum in the Hebrew. Go ahead and say sum. Sum, and it means, but here's the thing, to determine, great, establish, fine, transform into. There is this broad, beautiful meaning that gets at, oh, interesting. Here's the thing. To do that, it can be a simple word that just describes what he did. He resolved, as in he determined. But really, when you look at that transform into, we're heading somewhere, this gets at the work that actually needs to be done beforehand to be able to resolve. Are you with me? Because you don't just go, I'm not doing that. Why? You had this sketched out somewhere deep in your being that you knew what you could and could not do, what was fine and what would take you off sideways. And so that's the work that I want to lean into a little bit, because I wonder if that's what Daniel was doing as they're trekking across the desert. His head and heart are probably spinning, and he's thinking to himself, where are we going? What are we doing? What is happening? But then he begins to go, I have to know who I am, whose I am, and wherever we go and whatever happens, I've got to know where I stand, how I will stand, right? Because to be able to resolve, you have to do this interior work. And I wrote it this way. I would expect that Daniel's tapping into, resting in, and pulling from an interior alchemy, which provides him an exterior posture of calm strength. In order to resolve, there is an intentional turn to the divine alchemist to transform the mind and heart, which tend to be soaring, swirling emotions, feelings, frustrations, and fears. So when Daniel speaks and acts, he doesn't simply transmit the chaos, he transforms it. It's done inside because he has turned to the one, the divine, his Lord, his God. And he's like, you shape, mold, transform my heart and mind. So when I'm in this position, I don't just transmit the chaos that I've been tossed into. I have a transformed heart that speaks with this non-anxious presence that says, excuse me, I'd like to ask for permission not to do that. Wow. We could stop right now and just take that. What would it look like to be able to respond by this calm asking permission to refrain? Like just doing that work. We could stop right here, but you know we're not anywhere near stopping. Because there's much more to go. But that right there, whoo-wee. Here's what I believe Daniel knows. He's picked up on. The simplicity of civility is a robust way of displaying one's faith. The simplicity of civility is a robust way of displaying our faith. Sure. How you behave towards someone who's pushing, saying you're going to do this or whatever, when you can just come back, oh, interesting. Let's have a conversation. Daniel asks for permission. Okay. Daniel asks for permission, which is this calm, care-filled conversation. Let's keep digging. Verse 9. Verse 9 says, now God had caused the official to show favor and compassion to Daniel. Now, when I study this, I was losing it a little bit because this bugged me. And when you dig in, the word caused there is the word nathan. Go ahead and say nathan. Nathan. Now, here's the thing. It means to entrust. Caused is a terrible translation. Now, it's the NIV, but it's a terrible, because it means to entrust. So it actually means Daniel has been entrusted to this official. Because if we say it's caused, then what does that sound like? It sounds like the divine has cast a spell on the official to act in a certain way. He caused him to do that. But that's not what it means. It's he entrusted, so it's better. Better translate that Daniel is trusting that the official will offer mercy and grace. And we actually find this in Robert Alter as a scholar. He wrote this whole Hebrew commentary and translation for 30 years, as you do. Imagine that. This one little assignment's going to take me 30 years. That's how long he spent. And so I want to look at that. This is Robert Alter's translation and his commentary we'll get into. But and God made Daniel find grace and mercy in the presence of the chief of the officials. So now we're going to dig into this, but you understand it's no. It's actual Daniel who's going to go, how am I going to behave? This guy's, I'm entrusted to him. How will I respond to this? And he finds grace and mercy from this authority figure. So let's dig into those words, because these two words, hoo-wee, grace and mercy. Now, first one is chesed. Go ahead and say chesed. Yeah, chesed. Careful around you. Chesed, loving kindness, goodness, mercy. This is how, this is one of the ways the official acts towards Daniel. And then the second word is racham. Go ahead and say racham. Racham, which actually means womb. It's as cherishing the fetus in the womb, that kind of care. Compassion from the bowels, which we go, no thanks. Go ahead and keep that compassion if you would. But they understood in this time in the ancient world, in biblical time, the bowels were seen as the seat of one's being, the center that you're pulling from. They would understand it as compassion. We would understand it as something else. But it is this thing. What this official extends to Daniel is fascinating. It is this care as if a fetus in the womb. It is this mercy to Daniel. What? How did we get here? This specific language highlights how the official extends genuine kindness and care for Daniel, which we see displayed in their calm give and take conversation. Daniel seems to be operating with a stunning, non-anxious presence, which reveals that, and this is really important, Daniel doesn't allow his circumstances to dictate his way in the world. Oh, do our circumstances impact us? Absolutely. Do they dictate us? Nope. Daniel's like, yeah, this is not ideal. This is wild. But you don't see Daniel lose the plot, fly off the handle. He understands this is difficult, but it's not going to dictate who I am, how I am in the world. It'll impact me, but it's not dictating how it is. Of course, Daniel is drawing from something much deeper. And we're seeing this. Verse 10. But the official told Daniel, I am afraid of my lord the king who has assigned your food and drink. And the your here is plural. You all, you people that it's going to. Why should he see you all looking worse, but when you're the one asking for permission, so now it's Daniel, you want a different diet? Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king then would have my head, and that's literal. It's not a euphemism. Because of you, I die. I get decapitated. So who's the one who actually has fear in this situation? Daniel seems to be calm, but this guy's like, listen, I know he'll go off the rails. And I'll be the one that pays. So he's the one that has concern. So through the way Daniel has related to and interacted with those in authority, though, this official offers care and compassion to Daniel, knowing full well that it could get him in trouble. Now, how does Daniel respond? This is brilliant. Daniel then said to the guard whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please, so Daniel's response, oh, okay, well, please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables or grains to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. And so the official agrees and tests them for 10 days. Now, that word test is the word nesa. Go ahead and say nesa. Nesa is to tempt, try, put to the proof. Go ahead and put us to the proof. Try us, test us, go to it. Fine, so be it. Here's the thing. Daniel essentially says, oh, no, no, no. You do what you need to do so that you don't get in trouble. And then you just act according to the results. That's fine. He's in this conversation. And the official agrees. Once again, there is this brilliant, calm interaction. It's the way I thought of it. It's like someone, because this is enemies taking you and hauled you off to a foreign land. It's like someone made a war movie and the war movie's rated PG because of the way it unfolds. What kind of this, the wisdom we can glean from this. So he says, go ahead and do that. Verse 15, at the end of the 10 days, they, Daniel and his buddies, looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them what they wanted, gave them vegetables instead. First, now let's just be honest here, right? So they only ate vegetables for 10 days and they're better nourished, stronger than all the others. So first we just have to point out that the author of Daniel just sided with parents for all time. Kids eat your vegetables and kids are like, that Bible. Right? Eat your vegetables, kids. Thanks a lot, Daniel. I just laughed at that. I'm like, yeah, well, okay. The Hebrew phrase, now here's what's fascinating. For better nourished is best translated as plumper in the flesh. That's how it's best translated. Plumper in the flesh is that, but what it's saying is, and for that to happen, what we have to know, this is what we would call a minor miracle. It's a miracle. They ate vegetables, grains, and drank water, and they were better nourished, plumper in the flesh, and stronger than those that are having the king's meal. This story is super annoying. Hey, I only eat vegetables and drink water, and you look bad. Okay, that's right. All right, that's just me. Verse 17, to these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kind. Wow. Wow, 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 wow. So the healthy eating is one thing. Here's where I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. The healthy eating is one thing, but now we are told that Daniel and his three friends are educated in all kinds of literature. And where does it say that they receive their ability to absorb such knowledge and the ability to understand it all? the divine. So what you're trying to tell me is the divine allows for secular learning? What? Public education? Heresy. Do you see what's happening here? They just had this broad global studies put on them, and they're like, yeah, we'll learn that. And we're actually gifted with the ability to learn this really well. Yeah. It's as if we are being invited to bring our whole selves, heart, body, and mind fully into the world. Because this would create an opportunity for us to connect with and be good news to all people. Hoo-wee. Now, this is an invitation to shatter our compartmentalized walls of religion and piety over here, work and intellect over here. You mean maybe it's food and sex. Well, that's way, way over here. Let's just put these in. And right here in this story, it's like no. This is called life, and we're gonna immerse ourselves in all of it. We're gonna be educated. We're gonna understand, and that understanding and education comes from the divine. Yeah, it's not only were they immersed in the broadest education, but what's it say? They learned it better than everyone else. Wow. So offensive in some ways. Maybe for us. Daniel 1:18, it says this, at the end of the time, that's 3 years, the end of the time set by the king to bring them into his service, the chief official now has presented them to Nebuchadnezzar, which is the name of the insane king, King Nebuchadnezzar. If you're considering having more kids, Nebuchadnezzar, might I suggest as a name for you. Hey, Nebi. It's great. Nebuchadnezzar, after 3 years, Daniel and his friends receive advanced degrees in world religion and empire management and administration. That's what they're being educated in. They get advanced degrees, do it better than anyone else, and then they're awarded an interview with the global leader, the global military superpower, the leader of that, who has, by the way, he's responsible for your exile. And now you're standing before him. And in verse 19, we pick up that. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. These two verses boldly confront the religious subculture prevalent around us. Wow! The word for magicians here is hartumim. Go ahead and say hartumim. Hartumim, we will put it up on the screen, but here's the thing, it's an Egyptian loan word. There's something fascinating the writer's doing here, which shows up in this word, hartumim, by the way, it shows up in Joseph's story in Genesis, as well as Moses' story confronting Pharaoh. It's an Egyptian word. Then the word for enchanters is ashaifim. Go ahead and say ashaifim. It's an Akkadian loan word, highlighting that the wisdom that these men just are gaining have gained is global, and it far exceeds the professional sages of two of the world's global military superpowers, Egypt and Babylon. And it's like, oh yeah, that, what he's trying to communicate is they know this better than all of them. Whew. It is stunning. Now, to even survive this long, to get to this place where they're standing before the king, Daniel and his friends had to make some very, very difficult decisions, did they not? About what to hold on to, and what they can just have open hands and say, no, I'm not going to worry about that. I'm going to just let that go. Which brings us to Alexander Hamilton of Broadway musical fame, right? Alexander Hamilton is credited with saying this, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. Right? And so we get to this thing, and then this statement right here by Alexander Hamilton was hijacked by a bunch of religious fundamentalists who run the streets with their bullhorns, shaming and guilting people. stand for something, blah, 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 and yell at you and make you feel like garbage, right? Maybe you've heard this. Sure. Yeah, figure it out, sure. Figure it out. We got to figure out what we're doing here. But here's the thing. My goodness, we got a lot to go. I want to give you a key principle of Bible study. One of the most important principles of Bible study is what we're gaining right here in this story. If we have a flat reading of the Bible, as in the entire Bible is on equal ground in its authority, then anyone can pull any verse from any place at any time there, rip it out of context, and weaponize it to get at whatever dogmatic rule and system they are trying to enforce at that time. You can do that. Easily you can do that. Imagine if that happened. Just imagine, if you would, if that happened. This might lead to the Bible being experienced as a burden for people then. You could flatly say, if you do that, then you can say, this story tells us not to literally eat the food of the king, whatever that means, right? Oh, what we're told here is not to eat the food of the king. But for Daniel, this is about fidelity to the divine. So Daniel, for his day and in his way, this is what he understood to be a stumbling block for him. This will take me on. Why? This would take him sideways, disrupt him, take him to be off. He's like, I'm not doing that. So he resolved not to eat the food. Daniel knew his center, held to his center, and lived from his center, which takes us back to our Harbor Church's vision statement that we unpacked all last series, and we'll put it up. We create communities of belonging centered on Jesus, where people are formed and sent to be good news. We are saying our center, our foundation, and our guide is Jesus. The fancy theological term is hermeneutic. But you're like, ooh, I don't know if I want to say that. Right. Simply put, Jesus is the lens we look through and live through to see our world. That's how we begin to discern and walk through this, which takes us to the last week of that series where we had Pastor Tierra here, and she taught us how the early church in the book of Acts had some decisions to make on what does it take to join the faith community. Because they had endless laws and rules. There was the initial 613 laws or rules, and then they had all kinds of rules. They created them to build a fence around those rules, and so you see them build up. And so by the book of Acts, though, what they do is after Jesus, the church leaders start thinning that binder. Whoa. Why? They start saying, hey, our ancestors have been following some of this stuff for 1,000+ years, and we actually need to start thinning that. We can just like read through it, and you're like, oh, they got rid of that. How interesting. Yeah, they've been following it some 1,000+ years, so it wasn't, oh, good for them. They decided that was going to be a problem. It's really easy to do that. So what was once helpful, let me put it this way, for people who were grappling in their infancy with the divine have now become a hindrance to those who have a more developed understanding of the divine. I thought to cling to the initial laws is like refusing to potty train a child and just keep strapping diapers on your now teenager, which would actually hinder them from flourishing in the world, correct? Yeah, and you're welcome for that image. But do you see what's happening? If we're just like, no, we're just sticking with this, we're sticking with this, and all of a sudden you're like, eh, now they're a teenager, it's a little awkward throwing these diapers on them. Yeah, and so they're like, no, we're going to move on. Later on, one of the first followers of Jesus, Paul, a guy named Paul, Saul Paul, writes at least a few letters to the church at Corinth, and his first letter has him correcting them about which leader is the top leader. As in, who is the smartest, strongest, holiest, blah, 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 you know, my dad can beat up your dad kind of bickering. And Paul lays it out with both simplicity and profound depth when he says this. What, after all, is Apollos? Some of you have followed Apollos. You've learned from him. And what is Paul? He's speaking of himself. How odd. Only servants through whom you can trust. Hey, listen, we're servants who you came to trust. The Lord has assigned to each his task. For we are God's co-workers. You are God's field, God's building. Don't you know that you yourselves are God's temple, and that you is plural, you together are God's temple, and that God's Spirit dwells in your midst? So then, verse 21, so then no more boasting about human leaders. All things are yours. Whether Paul or Apollos, watch this, or Cephas, which is Peter, or the world, or life, or death, or the present, or the future, all are yours. And you are of Christ, and Christ is of God. All things are yours. All of it is your teacher. All of it is your teacher. Apollos taught you one thing. Fantastic. Paul taught you another. Hey, Peter, he taught you something else. Brilliant. Of course, education is everywhere. Truth. Truth is everywhere. All truth is God's truth. If it's true, it's true. So listen. It's all yours, the world, life and death, the present and the future, the here and the now and later, it's all yours. You have to do the discerning work of nope. Oh, interesting. That's helping me. Very interesting. Yeah. It's as if the movement of the divine is about an all of life experience that is dynamic and keeps becoming more. Paul says, hey, I got a role. Your role, though, too, is our role is to take the ever-expanding dynamism of the divine, absorb it, then steward it for the benefit of everyone else. Because we are servants. We are the divine's co-workers. And this is both stunning and overwhelming. So where does this lead us? Well, this leads us, and you're all just ready for this. This takes us to dolphins, buzzards, and a Mariah Carey. Naturally. Here's the thing. Are you with me? Yep, okay, good. A dolphin can hear frequencies as high as 150,000 hertz. The average human speaks in the 100 to 220 hertz range. Your average soprano singer might hit as high as 1,500 hertz. Mariah Carey and her 1990s hit song Emotions hit 3,135 hertz. And we went, wow. Uh-oh, wait, but a dolphin can hear 150,000 hertz. Did you know a buzzard can see a field mouse from 15,000 feet in the air? That's almost 3 miles away. A buzzard can see a field mouse. Animals see, hear, and experience the world very differently. The dolphin can hear things other animals cannot, as well as humans. The buzzard can see things other animals cannot, as well as humans. So the way a buzzard and dolphin and human experience the world is very, very different. Scientists who study animal behavior are called ethologists, and they have a word for how an organism sees, hears, and experiences the world. It's called its Umwelt, U-M-W-E-L-T, but it's a German word, so it's pronounced Umwelt. Go ahead and say Umwelt. Yeah, that's a good one. Right. Now, this Umwelt is, of course, it includes humans. So here's the thing. This is even before factoring in cultures, personalities, and language. There is then, and this is the key, there is reality as it is, and then there's the way animals and humans experience reality, and that's known as their Umwelt. Our senses they actually help shape how we experience the world. Now, here's the fun. Maybe you are like, I love Christmas because we have all the decorations and it's so joyous and beautiful and all of that. I remember years ago when my brother-in-law, who is now 32, when he was in third grade, I remember I got to know the family well back then. For years, he's like, why is the joyous, most celebratory time of the year decorated in such dull, boring, awful ways? And his family's like, what are you talking about? Here's the thing. To my brother-in-law, red and green look like muted gray. Basically, the world to him at Christmas time looks like an ashtray. And he was like, what gives? And they're like, oh, so then when I went over to their house is decorated in radiant blue, blue lights, blue ribbons, blue everything, because blue to him is stunning. Oh, so they just had to learn, oh, interesting. There is reality and there's how you perceive it. And so we make some adjustments so we can all celebrate, because really the whole point is joy. So when this is about discerning and learning how you encounter and experience the Christ, that which is deepest within, from that which is all around us. And then learning how to offer people grace when they encounter and experience this in different ways. Are you with me? This is where we're going. 13th century theologian Thomas Aquinas, of the school fame, he said this: whatever is received according to the manner of the receiver. Now, he said this over 800 years ago. That's in-depth psychology, is what we would call. By the way, before psychology was like a topic or subject. That's awesome. He knew, he tapped in, oh, okay, but we have to get this. Now, Franciscan Father Richard Rohr of today says it this way: people don't see things as they are, they see things as they are. Are you with me? Yeah. Which takes me to 4 years ago, sitting in a very specific site in Israel. I won't tell you the site because maybe you go on a trip someday with me to Israel. No, no, no. But we're sitting in the specific site in Israel. We're listening to a Bible teaching and this thing. And all of a sudden what happens is I'm listening to this teaching and I'm like, oh, oh yeah. And my insides start getting really, really warm and my foot starts tapping and my hand. And I'm like, oh, oh, I got questions. Because what I realize is the body is simply the echo of the soul and things are being stirred. And I'm like, I shoot my hand up and I'm like, I got a question. And I'm like, hold on here. What you're teaching. And I'm like, are you talking about those people back then here in this place? Or are you talking about us Americans today and how we are living? Which are you talking about? Because I'm picking up what you're saying here in your teaching. And as soon as we get done, one of the guys on our trip pins me to the bus and he sticks his finger in my chest. And he says, if you ever infer anything more in that way, you will pay. And I stepped back and I said, we were both listening to the same exact teaching, but we were hearing it clearly through different umwelts. Are you with me? And I'm like, wow, I turned to my wife and I'm like, I thought it was pretty obvious. And she's like, yeah, you're way behind. And I'm like, right. And I'm like, so what happened? Oh, then I sat with him at dinner and listened to his story. And I'm like, oh, I see. Because of where you are coming from, you heard that very differently. Maybe it's your upbringing. Maybe it's your schooling. Maybe it's less an experience you had and more the news channel you listened to. There are lots of things shaping our umwelt. Here's the thing. The goal is to discern the Christ, the center, that which is deepest within. Because as we learn and grow, we say things like, then I learned something new and my world became bigger, wider, deeper. We come to learn the ways and practices and disciplines that help our soul flourish and grow and have a deeper depth to living, which tends to do one of two things. It can help us hold all of the rest really loosely. Oh man, I'm learning. I got this core and I can hold this loosely. Or because we want to be free people and we want others to experience as life-giving, joy-producing people. Non-anxious presence. Or we could take our umwelt and saddle it on others, hold them to our ways and our understanding, and that probably would be brutal. Because in case you haven't heard, our society is fractured and viciously fighting. So here's the turn. We can stick with only our umwelt, and we actually can call our umwelt reality. In fact, a whole group of people could get together and frighteningly call it absolute truth, And that, though, would be tragic, because that would place ourselves as the all-knowing and keepers of absolute truth, and that actually belongs only to the divine. Correct? Yeah. So this might lead us to expect all cultures and systems and structures to bend or bow to our umwelt. Maybe we demand others talk like us and eat like us and see like us and hear like us. And if they don't, they are obviously stupid, ignorant, or less than, or maybe they're the enemy. This would create huge divisions, because then people are either against us or for us, not based necessarily on reality, but on our experience of reality, which is our umwelt. But what if the sacred curiosity led us to learn how to listen and connect with others, discerning how to be centered on that which matters most while holding all else very loosely? Because the reality is we're all exiles. We're all exiles. We are all learning how to be in this world, stepping into conversations, hopefully with mercy and grace, and with a deep compassion drawn from our center, which leads us to the last verse of Daniel chapter 1. And it says this: "And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus." What is this? Cyrus is the Persian emperor who comes along and conquers Babylon. Why is that interesting? Because emperors come and go, but Daniel, the centered one, remains. Are you with me? Yep, this whole thing will just keep on turning pages. A new emperor. Daniel remains. He's the centered one. And oh, by the way, Daniel in this story, 15, 16, maybe 17 years old. There's some work that he's been doing. He's dialed in, he's listening, and he's allowing a transformation inside to lead how he lives out here, even when he's hauled off as an exile into a foreign country. And then he's like, you got to do this, and you got to do this. And Daniel's this non-anxious presence says, hey, could I not do that? And I'll do this. And in fact, I trust that the divine will help me do this better than everyone else. But this I'm not going to. Could we talk about that? I'm not going to do that. Emperors come and go, but the center one remains. May that be said of you and I. Gracious God, yeah, we bless you, God, for speaking to us. We bless you, God, for such creativity. You speak to us in so many ways. You know us. You have known us. You created us. And the massive diversity in which we are, you, God, we bless you for connecting with us, for loving us, for teaching us, for guiding us, for inviting us forward in such diverse, creative, brilliant ways. And we trust that you will help us discern. You will give us eyes to see, ears to hear, and hearts to understand what is it that takes us off course? What is it that would have us stumble, trip, and fall? That we would know that, know where to stand and say, not that. But then knowing what all else we hold so loosely, because we have our center. We bless you, God, for the ways you teach us and guide us and lead us and pour into us. May we be open to you, and may that lead us to make our way in the world. We bless you for that. We praise you for that. And we ask simply more, please. More, please. Here's your church. May you continue as you do, God, to just teach us and guide us and lead us, that we would say yes to you and your voice and your leading. Amen.